the interest of time, we will start, because there's a lot that we want to celebrate today on International MSL Day. So thank you so much to my esteemed panelists for joining me on this exciting occasion. I'm delighted to be joined today by Vic Ho, Medical Excellence Consultant, Valentina Svetic, and Jody Tainton. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Helen.
Yeah, these webinars are always great fun. And people say afterwards, I really enjoyed that. So I've got no doubt that today is going to be any different. So firstly, a very important disclaimer that each of these panelists are speaking in their own right and not on behalf of their organisation. So let's start by setting the scene. Just a little bit about us for anyone that doesn't know about One MSL. Back in 2017, I founded, it was in fact called Pivot MSL with a view to driving MSL excellence. And today we are a specialist medical affairs training and consultancy. And we have trained, as you can see in this slide, 5,000 plus MSLs and medical colleagues throughout the world. So we are very privileged to be able to do that. And our mission, and I guess this is really my North Star, what drives me, is really to enable individuals and organizations to support best in class capabilities in ultimate achievement of product and patient focused objectives. So that is what drives us. And back in 2017, we asked industry to tell us, what words do you associate with MSL excellence? And this is a word cloud of the words that were used at that time, and lots of very familiar words there. And the words in larger font are in fact the words that were used most often. So I want you to hold this slide in your mind, because what you're going to see is a shift. It's how excellence has shifted over the last 5 years, because what we see here is that the words are very strongly leading towards scientific engagement. And of course, that's not surprising, because that is, at the end of the day, the role of the MSL. But that word cloud led us to create the MSL excellence framework that we use to underpin everything that we do. And in 2018, we were already in a very fast moving and evolving industry. We had McKinsey publish the vision for medical affairs. I mean, my goodness, 2025 is only 2 years away now. But we had papers talking about the superheroes of pharma. So this was after I spoke at a meeting in Barcelona, and this was the publication that evolved. So the role of the MSL was being taken very, very seriously, and people could see the opportunity. But we wanted to gather some data. So we launched our first excellence survey back in 2018, and we had 230 participants, which was great, from about 18 countries. So fast forward 5 years, what has been achieved? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to start and set the scene about where we are currently, start by thinking about how excellence has been redefined. And you can see that industry now talks about excellence in a different way. The words that we see on the right are the words that industry is using, they're associating with excellence. So have you got any initial thoughts on that, Vic? What do you think about when you see the shift from 16 to 21?
This doesn't surprise me at all, actually, because the MSL has to be all things to all people. And actually, probably the most important person in that is the healthcare professional representing the needs of their patient. And when you speak to KOLs or thought leaders or HCPs, whichever terminology the company is using, they very clearly want from the MSLs that strategic level of communication. They can get their data from many, many different sources, including other sources within the company. But what they need is the ability to tap into the strategy and the R&D strategy for the company, the strategic vision for how the company is trying to help them to help patients and change the treatment paradigm. So this idea of a sharing of insight between the external clinical community and the internal strategic individuals that the MSLs work with has always been important. But right now, when we're talking about how we manage those conversations within the company, the MSLs have to be there and have to be supported in their development to be able to do that. And I know that you're going to speak about that in the rest of the webinar today.
Fantastic. Thank you. That's nice setting the scene. Valentina or Jodie, anything you'd like to add to what Vic's just said?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is, as Vic said, not surprising. It really reflects the evolving role of the MSL over the past few years. We have really moved from being a scientific powerhouse to becoming a function where our aim and our objective is to build true collaborative partnerships. And part of that is really being able to uncover the needs of the HCPs that we're speaking to and to be able to address those needs in a multitude of different ways, not just the provision of data when we're asked to do it, but also a variety of other ways which help to underpin all of our business objectives. And as Vic said, it is really important to identify that MSLs need to be supported with developing the skills that will enable them to then develop those collaborative partnerships.
Fantastic. Well, look, let's now go to some of our more recent findings of the survey, because I think these really do acknowledge the achievements that have been made, because that's what this webinar is about. And in 2022, we had fantastic contribution to the survey. We had 562 respondents from 61 countries. And you can see the spread of respondents here. So it's fabulous. So it's true global representation. And the objective really of this survey is to understand current reality for not only MSLs, but also for MSL managers and leaders. And I'm just going to build on the word cloud theme. Here we have this question that was asked: do you believe that the MSL role in your organization is seen as a scientific, so it was a scientific support function, or a strategic business partner? So people could rate that on a scale of 1 to 10. And what we can see is that for some people, they still feel that this is the role is here, but actually 64% are rating it at greater than a 6. So we're starting to see this shift. And this is perception. This is recognition. There are lots of contributing factors around how people might answer this question. So, you know, back in the days when I was an MSL, the expectation was that I would be this individual on the left-hand side of this screen. I would only engage reactively. I was very much there as a supporter for my sales colleague, a scientific supporter. And when I had to face a question, I was always focused on, am I able to address this scientifically? I wasn't thinking about it with respect to insights and respect with respect to going deeper. So this really is what we think about more when we think about the strategic scientific MSL, this whole sort of shift, and of course, reflecting the different ways in which we engage now as well. Let's think now about competencies and upskilling. One of the questions we asked was, is there a competency framework for the MSL in your organization? And we can see that this is starting to change. We can think about upskilling as something that really takes your skills to a new level. So I've got the questions. Take a moment, panelists, to look at this, and then I'd like to come to each one of you. What are your thoughts on the identification of MSL needs? Let me come to you, Vic.
I'm a great believer in the individual, and I think it's tempting for any business to look at identifying the gaps and filling the gaps, which is an important part of how that training or capability offering or coaching is delivered. But at the same time, I think every company will be encouraging through its leadership the MSLs to identify their own needs and ask for what they need in today's environment. Because especially if there's an experienced MSL that has been doing this well before the advent of digital technologies and the way that we work now cross-functionally. They're the best, they're the experts in their own development, and it really needs to be driven by their development. So I think today is a celebration of MSLs and really giving MSLs permission to step up and ask for what they need to do what is a very complex role, and not try to just be passive as a learner in that environment and take what's given, because there is always more that you can ask for. So I would just encourage everyone to just speak up and ask for what you need, because the companies need expect a lot from you. You can certainly expect a lot from your company.
Thank you. Valentina, what are your thoughts on upskilling needs?
I completely agree with Vic. It is important for the MSLs to feel supported and empowered to ask for what they need. I would, however, say that sometimes there is a case of you don't know what you don't know, and there's a whole set of varying needs. And I think that actually doing a training needs analysis is very important. It is something that I sort of cobbled together in my previous role for the team to uncover where they felt that they felt a little bit less confident, because there's a whole set of different skills that you need as part of an interaction, before an interaction, after an interaction, and really uncovering where they felt like they needed a little bit more support, where they felt like they weren't completely confident. And it reveals some surprising insights. And I think it also revealed for the MSLs themselves at times that there were areas that they didn't realize until they really stopped and reflected on it and thought about it, that they needed a little bit more help.
Thank you for those of you online who said through the conversation with the manager. So that's absolutely endorsing what we're hearing here. Jody, but I'm interested to know, because I know this is something you're particularly passionate about.
Yes, Helen, I agree with everything Vic and Valentina have said. I take an approach of using a learning need analysis with the team. I think it works both ways. A lot of the knowledge is in the room, and you also don't know what you don't know. So when I've conducted learning need analysis for my team, I like to look at two different aspects. What do they think they need? And then what do we think they need as an organisation? And almost do two separate measures. The way that I've considered learning need analysis in the past is to look at the capabilities that make up the position description or the role for the MSL, and break that down into smaller sections, and then look at each component of that and have for me, it's about conducting a one-on-one conversation with the person and digging that little bit deeper into understand exactly where they're at and what they want to grow. But to uncover or expose where someone who's brand new in a role might not even know that that's a gap or a need that they have. So the purpose of the learning need or training need analysis is twofold. One, to help me develop the training to support the team, but also for the one-on-one conversations as well, for that individual's coaching and development.
Absolutely. So if we can identify what mastery is, what are the competency levels associated with excellence in engagement? What does that really look like? That then really allows you to do this gap analysis to identify where people are today and really where we want them to be. But I imagine, and I'm just curious, you know, so when we have the findings of these training needs analysis and we think about the triangle of success, so we've got engagement skills, we've got strategic acumen, we've got scientific expertise. Is it realistic that every organization is set up to respond to all of the identified training needs? What are your thoughts on that, Vic? How can expert training be provided and supplied by every organization?
Yeah, and I think this really comes to what Jody was saying, is when you have a training needs analysis and you're able to group people together with the same need. And I think that's really important against those capability frameworks, because there are those individuals that prefer to learn as part of a group. And there'll be the type of people listening to this webinar today who want to hear what their colleagues are saying or would like to be involved in something more of a discussion than just be given one little learning path for themselves. So I think in order to deliver that, you do need to have an organized plan of the types of capabilities offerings that you can give. And that requires investment from the the company. And you know, that bit that you showed earlier about the perception that from companies that MSLs are moving into this more complex strategic partnership place, I hear that a lot. And I know, Helen, we've been doing some work with the Field Medical Excellence Forum across all of these different companies to see what that looks like. And because the companies are recognizing this, there needs to follow the structures and the people and the experts in medical excellence to be able to support the MSLs, but also importantly their managers. And I know you're going to come on to that as well.
It really amazes me historically that there was always a huge amount of investment made in commercial, lots and lots of opportunities. And somehow I feel that as medical, we just have to fight much, much harder for investment to be made in the development of medical teams. And we have the privilege of working with incredible companies who, you know, really want to do the best for their teams, but they don't have huge budget. So we have to be creative. We have to be innovative. We want to work with them to really think about, you know, how can you address all of the needs of all of, because every individual is important in the most cost-efficient in manner. And that's responsible, and that is where we are today. And I think the idea today that, you know, you take one training course and you know, you provide that for everyone irrespective of what their needs are, well, I think it's much more about the needs of the individual and empowering and enabling individuals. That's where I feel things are changing as well. So really it is about managers listening to, identifying, and then being creative. And there's a wealth of resources out there. Upskilling for me is in fact, MSLs identify as one of their core challenges. And we will come on to that. I know that this is about achievements, but I think that the idea of continuous professional development aligned to this growth mindset is an achievement that has been made. Growth mindset is something that we talk about a lot today. Let's think about another finding from the survey. To some of you, this might be a shocking finding, but I would like to celebrate the positives on this slide, okay? That you can see the question on the screen, the number of coaching conversations that you've had. And the great news is that 12% of people are having 12 or more coaching conversations. That's fabulous. So let's assume that that's more than one coaching conversation a month. Unfortunately, there are those for whom this isn't happening. But Valentina, I know this is a particular passion for you. Would you like to share your thoughts on achievements around coaching that have been happening?
Absolutely, Helen. And it goes back to what we were saying on the previous slide. One size does not fit all. And there are many different ways of supporting and training and mentoring your team. And some of these approaches can be delivered quite effectively internally. Some of these need external expertise. Coaching, to me, is an incredibly powerful tool because it really does help to individualize the approach and to really work with the individual's needs. I am not speaking as a qualified coach. I am somebody who's extremely passionate about coaching. I would like to call myself an aspiring coach. Someday I would love to be able to do a coaching qualification, but I have done coaching as part of my role as an MSL manager. And I really do appreciate the importance of a designated, dedicated coach. Now, what struck me in this slide, Helen, is that those coaching conversations were delivered by either your manager, so the MSL manager, or a designated coach. I do really strongly believe that it is important to have a dedicated coach who has been trained and who is qualified to work as a coach. Speaking as an MSL lead myself, I know that all too often we are expected to deliver those coaching conversations as part of our role, but the managers do not get very much support or training in terms of how to coach and how to be a coach. And coaching is a word that gets bandied around an awful lot these days, but I don't think we always fully understand what coaching is and how coaching is different to training and how it's different to mentoring. And whether companies choose to have a permanent member on staff as an MSL coach, which, hint, hint, I believe they should, or whether they just bring someone in on a short-term basis to kind of help support and develop a team for a period of a few months, I do think that the dedicated coaching expertise and input is really, really critical.
Yeah, Jodie, what would you like to add to that? Because I know this is a huge part of your current role.
Yeah, I know. I'm coaching a large team of MSLs, and I think, you know, it's a shift, a mindset shift for people if they've reported directly to their therapy area or their medical director, you know, in the past to have an MSL coach. So part of, I guess, the I think it's a wonderful privilege to have an organisation that invests in that, and it is all about the MSL being the best they possibly can be. But it's also, you know, it is a mindset shift when an organisation moves to that model. So it's really important to ensure really strong internal collaboration between each therapy area and that person offering the coaching. So it's a success. So they feel that they really have a strong connection back to the brand or however the organisation's set up, and also that strong relationship with the coach. So I've found it's around resetting expectations and creating a desire for that coaching as well. And when people see the value that they can get from that, I think it's a privilege to have it, because many organisations don't.
No, I agree. And in fact, unfortunately we don't have time today to go through all of the findings of the survey, but if people would like to see them, you will find them on our One Community page. And what was really interesting there was the responses from the managers and the MSL leaders, the vast majority of whom, and I think Valentina, you spoke to this, are not provided with their upskilling needs being addressed in order to be the most effective coach. And we're launching a whole new series of workshops this year. And one of them is being, you know, optimizing how to optimize your role as an MSL manager. And really, you know, coaching starts with building trust, doesn't it? It's really building trust between the coachee and the coach. Coaching can be planned. Coaching can be informal. Coaching can just happen in a conversation. And I think that if an organization really supports this culture, and it is a cultural shift, Jodie, I think that's a really important point to make. But for many individuals, your coaching experience is only as good as the last coaching conversation that you had. If you had a conversation with a coach who believed that it was their job to tell you what to do, that's not coaching. That's really something that's back more in, you know, is that mentoring or is that coaching? So really defining what it means, first of all. So I think it is a hugely hot topic, but it's fantastic. You know, I know lots of really great managers who are great coaches, but only 40% of MSLs have designated MSL managers. The vast majority are reporting into medical directors or other individuals who may not have the time. So how can we support those individuals, Vic? So have you got any thought about that, about the people that maybe aren't in the privileged position of having a coach?
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Valentina, for really highlighting the differences and the types of conversations, because coaching is the intention is about empowering the person to be their best professional self. But at the same time, it's about increasing conversations, so increasing visibility in both directions of what MSLs do day to day as well. And that's the thing that's often missing if you're in a country where you report into a country medical director directly, or maybe even covering multiple countries. There are MSL positions that are one of just three medical affairs individuals across an entire region. And where that's the case, nobody has time to do these coaching conversations. And it's then about the cultural piece of how do we support each other as professionals? So coaching is in both directions, and it can be that it's just a brainstorming thinking session, a thinking partner session with your other medical affairs colleagues around a particular patient-focused issue in that set of countries. It's not the same as development coaching, but it's working together and it's breaking down those barriers between field teams and office-based teams and just increasing the conversation. But I agree with you, Valentina, if every company had dedicated, fully trained coaches. So this is not about the manager managing performance or directing an MSL to do a certain set of tasks, or this is what we need you to be focusing on, because that's not coaching. Then it would be great to have that resource within your organization, or even consider outsourcing that to. There are many providers with coaches that are very familiar with what it is to be an MSL, and so they're not coming from a completely unknown perspective. But it's such an autonomous role where MSLs work alone a lot of the time and are expected to be very outwardly focused. That takes energy, and to have some of that energy given back to them through their coach is a real valuable service that we can do.
We're working with one company at the moment in support of a team who don't currently have a medical director. And so we're an external organization, but sometimes there's a real advantage to that about being external to the organization and about being able to coach, because you're coming at it through a very different lens, and you're really able to focus on the individual and to really sort of, you know, all of that noise, that internal noise that can sometimes shape a coaching conversation or create distraction. So I completely agree. You know, if you're listening to this and you're not having regular coaching conversations, I think that there is huge value to be had in having those conversations. And, you know, even peer-to-peer coaching can work quite effectively. It doesn't have to, or self-coaching. There are lots of different ways that this can be approached. So for those companies that are lucky enough to have the Jodies, the Valentinas and the Vicks of this world, fabulous. But for others, please just know that there are solutions.
Helen, if you don't mind me just adding to that very quickly, I just want to mention that from my perspective, that element of vulnerability is really key to a really effective coaching conversation. So having that feeling of psychological safety where you can be really honest about the areas where you feel you probably need a bit more support, that element of vulnerability is not always there. If you are speaking to a manager, you might have the best manager in the world, but they're still the people who, you know, sign off your performance review at the end of the year. So you might not feel as comfortable as you would with somebody who is a completely separate individual, or sometimes, Helen, as you said, an external organization as well, which sort of adds to the value of having a separate coach from the MSL manager.
Yeah, and that is a piece about trust, really, isn't it? Yeah. That's kind of where I felt that you need to start, because if you feel that if there's an awkwardness or a tension in that relationship for whatever reason, then that's not going to probably create the best possible outcome for the coachee. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to achieve. And I think, unfortunately, for some people, they associate coaching with a performance issue. Oh, so we've noticed that this isn't happening, so we're going to create some coaching. So psychologically, as you say, that place of safety isn't there, because they're seeing it as punitive. They're not seeing it as a positive reinforcing experience. So yeah, I think it's very important to really understand what coaching means in your organization. So maybe that's a good starting point. How do we see coaching in this organization? What is the culture? What is the feedback? So changes in life cycle involvement. And this is, I think, one of the most fascinating achievements that have been made really over the last 5 years. Back in the days when I was leading the team at Celgene, we introduced trials feasibility questionnaires as a means of going out to really understand study sites' interest in participating in research. And it really was quite, I think it was quite an innovative approach at the time. And when we look at this question, where is your drug in its life cycle? So if we start on the right, 2019-20, the vast majority of people were post-marketing authorization. That's where they were working. A third of people were involved at phase three. But if we now look on the left-hand side, we can see the shift happening. And what I can tell you, and this is really exciting, our 2023 survey has just closed. So thank you to everyone who's participated. We had 17% of people are engaging at phase one. So what are your thoughts about this, Vic? What do you think when you look at these current findings? What does this mean for the MSL, for the opportunities?
Well, this is something we've been asking organisations for the almost 20 years that I've been in this space, is not to wait until 1 year prior to launch to allow MSLs to start speaking with trialists and that community of researchers needed to produce really high quality evidence for a product through its life cycle. So it's great to see that this is actually materializing now. It really reinforces the need for MSLs to have access to the strategy for a pipeline, for the aspirations that the company has for a product within its therapeutic area, and have access to the data scientists internally to have those conversations. Because to interact with people at phase one and phase two, one of the most important things the MSL does is contextualize the need for that trial data with the trialists, help them to understand the context of why is this study being done in this way, how does it add to the body of evidence for that patient type, and why therefore do we need the trialists' help in generating the data quickly and with rigor. So this is all part of that strategic partner piece, and it'd be great to see an increase in the connection between MSLs and the R&D teams and the clinical monitors. And I know that a lot of companies are placing the effort there to ensure that the MSLs are an extension of that clinical trials team, whether it's outsourced or in-house.
Fantastic. Jodie, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything Vic said, and I think the increasing percentages in phase one and phase two and phase three there add to or demonstrate the confidence that the organisation is also placing in the MSLs, that the MSLs are demonstrating their value and that trust has been built, and they're now, you know, starting them earlier in the process. And I agree with the involvement of the MSL early with the clinical trials departments and discussing the designs and the protocols and having being part of the conversation, you know, as that process evolves from beginning to end. And it's great to see it coming through in the data as well.
Yeah, so we're doing a program at the moment in the USA, which is essentially training a team of MSLs to an early pipeline team. And it's really, for me, it's just such an incredible opportunity, because if we as an organization, or if we as a company, are able to, it's not even getting to the point where we're contextualizing the need for, you know, talking about a specific study, if we're able to explore concepts, protocol concepts, and study designs, we can really gather insights in a way that we can learn a huge amount about the reality of treating patients. Because sometimes, of course, within industry, we have the view of the patient that is required for the study, which may in some ways be quite a long way from the reality of the patients that are existing out there in that therapeutic area pool. And through those conversations, MSLs are able to gather insight that can inform R&D teams, so that they might avoid really expensive mistakes. You know, if a protocol hasn't been appropriately designed and the recruitment targets aren't being met, then we're looking at you know, very expensive delays in terms of development. And so this idea that MSLs can gather insights, can build relationships with these trial investigators, those relationships, that those ultimately will be the individuals who, moving forward, can really talk about what their experiences have been around those studies. So we know that commercial are not able to engage in this space. So the value and impact of the MSL role for me in this entire pre-approval period is, it's really almost indefinable. There's just so much that they can bring to the table. But it does require a different set of skills, and it does require some different knowledge. And this is where we coming back to our upskilling needs. How do we identify what the upskilling needs are then for MSLs engaging in this space? I'm delighted to see these findings reflected. And I think that, you know, we will continue to see MSLs grow and evolve in the earlier life cycle phase. So now I just want us to think about, how can we empower the MSL? So I've used the word empowering. So how can we really empower MSLs? And if we look at this slide, which was a study, a survey question around, are you facing any of the challenges? Now, the top two findings, and I chose not to remove these because this is reality, were really post-COVID reflections. But thinking here about upskilling, what are your thoughts on empowering MSLs around upskilling? What can we do as leaders to help that? Any thoughts, Valentina? How would you like to empower your MSLs?
There are many, many different aspects to this. And I think it initially starts with awareness, self-awareness. I have met a lot of new MSLs who are new to the role, or MSLs who's maybe slightly less experienced, who sometimes don't even know what is actually expected of them. When they join industry, they get all the data training in the world, but they don't really get a lot of training around what does it mean to be an MSL? What is an MSL? What is expected of them out there in the field? So really just supporting them on their journey of self and awareness of understanding the MSL role, the impact of the MSL role, and how it can make a difference to the company's business objectives, and how their understanding of the strategic priorities of the business can really empower them to deliver. I think that is the beginning. But then also helping the rest of the organization to understand the MSL role better, and to provide a supportive framework to make sure that the MSLs are, that they're given permission to set time aside for upskilling, because some of that can be done with appropriate support, but some of them has to be done. It has to be self-driven and self-motivated. So I do think the understanding of the MSL role, although it is certainly moving in the right direction and it is getting better over time, there is still a lot of work to be done around that.
Yeah, fantastic. Jodie, any thoughts from you about empowering MSLs?
Yeah, I agree with Valentina that, you know, the organisation needs to give people time to, you know, grow their skills and learn the capabilities. But for me, a big part as well is we can have a moment in time where we give you really great training for a few days and we teach you some skills. But what happens beyond that is one of the big pieces to empower people to be the best that they possibly can be. Having on-demand training and self-directed type pieces of personal development are really valuable, and it comes back to then the individual really driving their own development. So if they want to be really great at, you know, building trust or engaging for impact or whatever it is, you know, getting in and learning it maybe in a face-to-face or a virtual webinar or in a coaching session, but putting in extra effort themselves to continue that learning, I think is what sets some people apart from others. You know, people who really want to grow that skill. I can think of, you know, I have some people that will come to me and say, hey, Jody, will you come out with me when I see this customer? Because I don't know what I don't know. And I just want you to give me the feedback. You know, they're really proactive, whereas others will not want you to be there at all. So, you know, it comes down to your own mindset and how you embrace it as well. And you will be more empowered if you do. And your openness to feedback as well, I think makes a really big difference in terms of how quickly you grow and embrace a role. If you're new in the role, you can see some people who are brand new and they go ahead in leaps and bounds really fast because they really dig deep and can be harder for others.
Fantastic. Vic, what are your thoughts on empowerment?
I really think this is also linked to which behaviours we encourage within an organisation as well. And often that's driven by the things that are held up as examples of value delivered by the efforts of MSLs. And so that's one of the things that across the companies we're talking about at the moment is, what are the things that people should be measuring and pointing towards as being excellent? Because those will allow the most competent and experienced MSLs to shine and be a beacon to other people's development. So I think all of us on this call, and probably people watching it, if you think of who is the most the best MSL that you've ever worked with, what type of attributes did that MSL display? I think we'd all come up with a similar sort of picture in our minds of somebody that really goes out of their way to support other people's knowledge, strategic understanding, other people's developments, and they offer their time and their insight freely, get involved in projects proactively, and are taking the time to drive what's needed for the patient. And as a result of that, they are very trusted by all of the experts that they work with. And that isn't something that is measured by a single simple metric, but it is something that can be highlighted and shown by an outcome type measure. So I think that's the next shift in the evolution of these teams, is how we find those outcome indicators that every company can get behind, rather than everyone trying their own little experiment that doesn't have the end numbers to be credible to the industry. But how can we actually start to see that move that then unlocks the support that MSLs have from their managers and from the leadership structures to accelerate even further? Because what's been achieved where we stand today is phenomenal. What can be achieved in the future is probably even more phenomenal than we can even imagine right now.
It's such an exciting time for this industry, really. For me, empowerment is that leadership truly understands the value and impact that the MSL can bring. And and leadership trusts the MSL to go out and build those scientific relationships, really engage on behalf of the patient, really be an advocate for the patient. Through that relationship, the MSL is ultimately able to affect patient outcomes because they are doing such an amazing job as an MSL. And I don't think it's easy. And I think defining what great looks like is changing. It's changing constantly. But I see that as part of our job. Let's help people define what does really great look like, so that then you can start to think about your gap analysis and identify what it is that you need to do to move along that journey of excellence or of greatness. So we've covered some high level achievements. What about the panelists? What do you feel if I'm putting you all on the spot because I haven't asked you to think about this in advance. But if you think about the world of the MSL, what do you think has been achieved?
I guess just that move to from being a support function to really being that strategic partner, and seeing, in my experience, seeing MSLs really step up and come forward with their ideas, advocating, making differences for patients, and that internal piece. I think I've particularly seen difference internally, demonstrating their value and being, getting that seat at the table more and more often, you know, rather than just being a reactive tool that is leveraged in the background, but becoming this, and obviously it depends in the country you work in and what the rules are, et cetera. But in many cases, being able to be a more proactive partner with their own independent strategy and direction. It's been wonderful to see that over the years become stronger and stronger and stronger.
Absolutely. And part of that community is really what we're doing with the Field Medical Excellence Forum that's been brought together by One MSL, is taking all these individuals that work in the sphere that we work in, which is in medical excellence and capabilities and support of medical affairs, and bringing all that passion, because many of these people have been MSLs back in the beginning of their career and they've managed MSLs. And so we've seen the needs evolve, and we want to work across the companies to find some really powerful ways of holding each other's hands through the journey. But in terms of the very basics of what can we do to all raise the bar for our teams, I'm seeing a much more willingness and openness to speak about those things now than there's ever been before. And I think it's because every company has MSLs now, and there's pretty defined boundaries of what an MSL does and doesn't do, more so now than there's ever been, even though that, of course, is evolving with different job titles in the field and different roles within medical affairs. There's a consensus there and a real willingness to make sure that everyone understands that, not just within medical affairs, but also in all the other functions within biopharma, so that we get the most out of that function, because it's often still, unfortunately, a little bit of an untapped resource. So let's keep celebrating what MSLs can do for patients.
Fantastic. Valentina, what about you? What are your thoughts and achievements?
I mean, really, just to echo what Vic and Jody have already said, one of the things that I've really observed over the years is an increase in MSL visibility. And again, although this is something that we still have some way to go, there's been a huge increase in an awareness in terms of what the MSL brings to the organization. The scope of the role has broadened hugely, as Jody already mentioned, from being really a support function that really works in that sort of post-marketing phase, supporting the sales team, to being a strategic partner. And that awareness that the work of the MSLs underpins so many of the company's activities, and it really helps us to build for the future, and it builds the success of the organization. That visibility also then brings in an understanding and an appreciation that this vital role needs appropriate support. And, you know, today we are here to talk about how we need to maybe focus more on those areas going forward, but also to celebrate the fact that already a lot has been achieved over the last few years. And hopefully this trend will continue, and our MSLs will continue to grow from strength to strength as companies provide more support and more time to empower and support the MSLs and really help them to take that mastery to the next level.
I am confident that is going to happen, Valentina. You know, Reuters published in a publication last year are predicting growth in the MSL community of between 10 and 25% over the next 4 years. So if we assume that this is going to happen, then that speaks to the opportunities for this role to really contribute most optimally. And thinking back to the desire that has become apparent from the Field Medical Excellence community that we now have, I can tell you, you know, in 2010, I went to a meeting in London, which was the first time pharma had come together to talk about the MSL role. And I know that that's really aging me some way, but at the coffee break in that meeting, a group of us came together and said, we need to do something for this function within the UK. And that was the meeting where the MSLA was conceived at, you know, the Medical Science Liaison Association on the back of that, we founded that association. And that passion and that drive, you know, that in itself has been a huge achievement. You know, that passion and that drive, I think, hasn't diminished in one iota. If anything, it has grown. I just want to, you know, we're in the last 30 seconds of this meeting, just say a huge thank you to Vic, to Valentina, to Jody, to Greg in the background, and to all of you who've been online and who've joined in the conversation, and to those of you that will watch this webinar on Catch Up, thank you for sharing the conversation with us. And we look forward to talking to you all in the very near future. So on behalf of 1MSL, thank you.